are listening to The Addiction Files, where we discuss evidence-based treatment, clinical pearls, and resources while striving to destigmatize the treatment of addiction in our medical culture and save lives. We are the addiction doctors, Dr. Darlene Peterson and Paula Cook.
Welcome to The Addiction Files. We are thrilled. We have Dr. Anna Lemke joining us, and this is such an honor. I am going to turn it over to Dr. Cook to introduce Dr. Lemke to us, and we'll get started.
Right. Well, we're delighted to have Dr. Anna Lemke. She's a professor of and medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University and the program director of the Addiction Medicine Fellowship. She's the author of two well-known books in our community, Drug Dealer MD and Dopamine Nation. And a lot of people recognize your name, Dr. Lemke, from the Netflix documentary that you were in a few years ago, The Social Dilemma. And then those of us in the medical community have probably seen you recently on the speaking circuit at some of the conferences. I know you were at CSAM last year and ACLM. And so that's you're a very busy lady working clinically and working, doing authorship as well. So we're appreciative that you're on the podcast today, and we really welcome you.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here and to talk with fellow addiction medicine docs.
Thank you so much for being here. And I really appreciated your first book, The Drug Dealer MD. I found it really validating as an addiction medicine physician on just the scope of the iatrogenic opiate addiction. How much progress do you think we've made in the medical community in recognizing and treating addiction?
I think we've made substantial progress, especially among the younger generation. So people now in medical school, nursing school, other forms of training, trainees, and early career folks, they seem to be much more attuned to this problem, the problem of addiction more broadly, the problem of overprescribing psychotropics, opioids, and other potentially addictive medications, much more cautious in that regard than I was when I, entered practice in the late 1990s. I that sea change is really encouraging. Also, there's just frankly, a lot more money and interest in addiction medicine now. So there's more dollars for research. There's more people going into the field. 15 years ago, I couldn't, find a medical student under a rock to rotate in my clinic. And now I'm turning them away. So I think in that sense, yeah, a lot of progress, really good. In terms of actually getting like real estate in the addiction medicine curriculum for medical students, it's better, but it still seems insignificant in comparison to the scale of the problem. Like that, that they're still getting like hours and hours, dedicated to some receptor, the pharmacology of some rare receptor, and as opposed to just learning basic addiction medicine, it's just astonishing to me, but that's where we are. And then, in terms of like actual practice, obviously we have a long way to go. I'm not saying that, yay, we're done, but I do think we're headed in a better direction.
Thank you. That's really encouraging. I noticed, and you really spoke to me, you talked about the implementation of these patient satisfaction surveys and how this has affected opiate prescribing. This is becoming more commonplace. And there's also seems to be when this is now being tied to physician payment and positive surveys, is this creating a perverse incentive to overprescribe?
Absolutely. It's not just is creating, it has created, it is still creating. It's a huge, huge problem. And then when you tie that to the type of person that goes into medicine, which is a person who generally wants other people to like them, wants to be the good guy, the healer, wants to sweep in and save people from their suffering. You have right there the perfect storm for overprescribing. Especially medicines that in the short term work great, even though in the long term, they're usually not very effective.
Yeah, no, that's so true. We talk about that all the time. It's just easier to just give people what they want. It's easier because it feels good for us, right. Often. And it's easier time-wise when people are under such a crunch to just not have the long, difficult conversations with people that actually lead them to, in a healthier direction.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, what happens is a slow moral injury and erosion of a sense of really doing good work and actually helping people, which, you know, I think is leading to more and more folks leaving the profession, retiring early, going into non-clinical roles. So, you know, what I always say to folks is, yeah, you know, it's painful in the short run for you and your patient. But in the long run, you know, if it really comes from an informed, evidence-based and compassionate decision-making process, then it's, you know, it's the right thing to do. And you will be better off in the long run because you'll find meaning and purpose in your work because people will get better. They'll actually get better.
What's your advice? Because we have more and more physicians moving into these employed situations and they are on these incentivized plans now that are in these situations. So they're in this situation where they're feeling this pressure to meet these quality surveys. Do we have any advice for them?
You know, one of my main pieces of advice is to actually fight these policies and fight these incentive structures. I thought when I went into medicine, all I had to do was, you know, learn how to be a good doctor, one human being at a time, and none of the rest of it mattered. But I have learned over the years that actually we can't do that anymore. We have to raise our voices. I know I'm not like a natural like advocate or a rabble rouser, but we really have to do that. I have to push back and say, like, it is not realistic for me to see this many patients, you know, in this span of time and be able to meaningfully cover the complexity that this patient represents with. It's unfair to me. It's unfair to the patient. It's unsafe. So I'm really, really pushing back and setting limits and just be like, I'm not going to do that. And also banding together, because it's one thing if one person, a clinical setting says, I'm not going to do that. But it's really when everybody's saying, nope, we're not going to, what are they going to, you know, hire a whole new set of people? Yeah, they might, but, you know, really kind of speaking up for what's good practice.
That's excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much. And like you said, it's the right thing to do for the patient. And we've all experienced patients coming back and saying, you know, being grateful that they were guided down that road rather than just being stuck in this situation where they're given dangerous drugs, addicting drugs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And what I always say to trainees is, you know, they may hate you today and they may even drop out of your clinic. But a lot of times, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, they'll remember that conversation and it might be the very conversation they needed to get into recovery. So just because you're not seeing the immediate consequences of an interaction, which you might have thought was negative or that led to that patient not returning, it doesn't mean it didn't have a positive impact. You know, I've been around long enough to see these patients come back like 5 years later and said, you know, I didn't want to hear what you had to say, but actually a year after you said it, I thought of that, and that was part of what helped me make a change.
I love that. That's Darlene and I attended the same residency, and we had a great behavioral health mentor who used to always say that you're just planting seeds.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's talk about your book and also just kind of the concepts that you present in your book, The Dopamine Nation, because it's so interesting and it's obviously been really well received in the public. So I just wanted to talk a little bit more about that. I know our listeners will be really interested in you discussing this topic of dopamine and why it's so important in the pursuit of pleasure and, you know, what other players are there. I'd just love you to give an introduction to that and we can discuss it a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, a big motivation for writing the book was the realization that we actually have some amazing neuroscience about what's happening in the brain as people go from recreational adaptive use of a substance or behavior to maladaptive addictive use. And this sense that if only the average consumer kind of had a handle on this information, it would help them. Also, my realization that, you know, some of these ideas that neuroscience is discovering are actually really old ideas that have been around for thousands of years, but people are not interested in hearing them unless they're packaged as neuroscience. So we do a lot of describing the basic neuroscience in our clinical interactions. So what I've done in the book and what I train my residents and medical students to do is to use a kind of a simplified metaphor of a pleasure-pain balance to explain to people what's happening in the brain as we become addicted. So imagine that in your nucleus accumbens, your reward pathway, there's something like a teeter-totter or a seesaw, like in a kid's playground, that represents how we process pleasure and pain. So this is how I'll talk to patients. And when we're at rest, that balance is level with the ground, unlike a real teeter-totter in a playground, which might be tipped one way or another. Ours is level with the ground. We call that baseline homeostasis. And by the way, we're always releasing dopamine at a kind of baseline tonic level. That is our homeostatic dopamine level in the reward pathway. One of the amazing findings in neuroscience in the past 75 years is that pleasure and pain are co-located in the brain, and they work like opposite sides of a balance. So when we experience pleasure, the balance tips one way, pain, it tips the other. There are rules governing this balance. And the first and most important rule is the balance wants to remain level. And our brains are going to work very hard to restore a level balance with any deviation from homeostasis. How do our brains do that? That's the key to understanding addiction. So let's say I do something that's pleasurable for me, reading a romance novel, eating chocolate. That releases dopamine, our reward neurotransmitter. My balance tips to the side of pleasure. No sooner has that happened than my brain adapts to that temporary increase in dopamine firing by downregulating dopamine transmission, not just to baseline, but actually below baseline. And I like to imagine that as these little neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again. But the gremlins like it on the balance, so they don't get off as soon as it's level. They stay on until that balance is tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the hangover, the come down, the opponent process mechanism, or that state of craving, right? Wanting to eat one more piece of chocolate, read one more chapter in my romance novel, watch one more TikTok video, or whatever our drug of choice may be. The drive to restore homeostasis is one of the overriding impulses for all living organisms. We are all about returning to our homeostatic baseline. So once we find ourselves in that dopamine deficit state, tilted to the side of pain, if we are presented with more of our drug, trust me, we will consume it because that's the fastest way to get us back up to baseline. And that, unfortunately, is what leads to the cycle of addiction, because as we continue to accumulate our drug of choice, those gremlins start to multiply. They get bigger, they get stronger, and ultimately they're camped out on the pain side of the balance. And now we've changed our hedonic or joy set point. We're walking around with a pleasure-pain balance, chronically tilted to the side of pain. We're in a chronic dopamine deficit state. And human brain neuroimaging studies will show this, that even 2 weeks after stopping use, people who have been using drugs in an addictive way have below normal levels of dopamine transmission. And that means that we now need to use more of our drug in more potent forms, not to get high and feel good or solve the original problem we were trying to solve, but just to level the balance and feel normal. And when we're not using, we're walking around experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving. And this is why people will relapse, even though their rational minds can tell them, my life is better when I'm not using. But their dopamine reward pathway is telling them, use, use, use. We got to restore homeostasis. Do anything it costs to get ourselves back to that level position. And I just feel like understanding that is fundamental, especially for our patients who will self-identify as self-medicating an underlying psychiatric disorder, right? They'll come in looking for help with anxiety, depression, inattention, insomnia. They'll be in their addiction vortex, but they'll identify their drug as self-medicating. What we need to communicate to them is it may be true that your drug in the short term restores homeostasis and you feel better, but in the long term, all you're doing is increasing the number of gremlins on the pain side of your balance, changing your hedonic set point, and that your relentless pursuit of this intoxicant is actually leading to more pain.
How do you think stigma, like the way, especially in the medical system where our patients are particularly stigmatized and are medically traumatized, how do you think the medical providers, us as a culture, can understand addiction better by understanding this? Because most people just think it's a moral problem. I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress in this regard, but do you think this would help people, you know, it's shift away from that kind of stigmatizing approach of people who have an addiction to something?
I do. I think it helps. I mean, first of all, let me say there are a lot of addicted doctors out there too, but you know, you don't hear from them very often. You know, a lot of docs in recovery, and there are a lot of folks that are open about that too, which is great. It really helps destigmatize. But if you think about the kinds of personality types and skills that go into medicine, it takes people who can engage in a lot of controlled self-regulation. Right. So these are people who probably on some level pride themselves in their ability to delay gratification and control their impulses. And I think a lot of the stigma related to addiction is a kind of condescension toward addicted people as being incontinent, lacking self-regulation, lacking the ability to control themselves, people who are selfish, who are self-indulgent, who just want to feel good and feel pleasure and you know, aren't trying to do any good in the world. And I think this is where the neuroscience can be super helpful to destigmatize, because it basically communicates this is, first of all, it's not about pleasure. Ultimately, it's about getting out of pain, right? It's this, what George Koob calls dysphoria-driven relapse. It's that balance tilted to the side of pain, people just trying to feel normal. But also when you think about the loss of agency, I think that's really important for destigmatizing. What may begin as a choice to consume or not consume a substance or behavior ultimately becomes less and less of a choice as that person gets more and more addicted. You know, so, and that I think was a real revelation for me in, you know, my working with addicted patients. I'll never forget a patient who called me up and said, "I'm surrounded by empty bottles. I want to stop drinking, and yet I just cannot stop. I'm going to go, you know, to the hospital and tell them I'm suicidal. Or no, I'm going to go to the hospital." What was it? She said, "I'm going to go to the hospital. How can I get help?" And she said, "Should I go to the hospital and tell them I'm suicidal?" I said, "Well, are you suicidal?" She said, "No, I want to live, but I can't stop drinking, and I'm going to die if I keep drinking." And yet, you know, even now, if you go to an emergency room and you say, "I can't stop using, please admit me and help me," you really won't get an admission. You have to endorse a suicidal stance in order to get that kind of contained environment where you can, you know, not hurt yourself. So it's even now, systemically, it's still very stigmatized and misunderstood, really.
And I love what you said, and it made me think too, and where it stigmatizes ourselves. I mean, the patient's self-shame and denigration is so hard to overcome as well, because they don't understand that this truly is a process that's happening on a neurochemical level. So,
Exactly. And so I think understanding that pleasure pain balance is really helpful for people to really, you know, medicalize it, make it less of a shameful thing, and just to understand, you know, like it resonates with people. Oh yeah, that's my experience, right?
How come the tolerance does not seem to work the same way for accumulating pain like it does for pleasure? So for example, why do high chronic loads of pain don't seem to result in the same kind of tolerance like we do for pleasure?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there is actually neuroadaptation to pain also. So when that pleasure-pain balance is healthy and robust and working the way it should, I mean, what's remarkable about humans is how we are able to adapt to really kind of crazy situations, you know, and psychologically and physically painful situations as well. So that is there. But it's also true that there's a kind of pain, especially, you know, like centralizing pain disorders, which are pain in the brain. They fundamentally arise from a physiologic problem with the parts of the brain that process painful experiences. The other thing, too, with physical pain is that how we culturally conceive of them and how we pay attention to signals of pain has a big impact on how we experience them. One of my favorite studies is a study of World War II soldiers who had these horrific battleground wounds, you know, amputated limbs, guts spilling out. And a very famous study was done where they were asked in the immediate aftermath of these injuries whether or not they had had pain and how bad the pain was. And amazingly, two-thirds of them endorsed having no pain at all. So there you have obvious severe injury and no pain. What could possibly be going on? Well, their injuries meant, number one, they were alive. And number two, they were probably going home. So the meaning of the injury completely changed their cognitive filter for how they experienced pain. So I think that's really, really powerful. Likewise, the inference of that, there's this really famous case report of this construction worker in England who jumps on a nail that goes right through his boot and right into his foot. He's screaming in pain. He goes to the emergency department. They give him opioids. They don't work. They give him more and more opioids. Finally, they give him enough. He's passed out and unconscious. And they carefully remove the nail and remove the boot and discover the nail has gone right between his toes. So in fact, there was no tissue injury, but his eyes saw the nail through his foot and I believe he had intense pain that was completely manufactured in his brain. So, let me get on a finer point of this too. You know, let me just say that one of the big stressors, as you know, for addiction and relapse in particular is psychological stressors, you know, or, you know, halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or other more severe forms of pain. We know that, for example, if you take a mouse that's been conditioned to press a lever for cocaine, that mouse will press that lever till exhaustion or in some cases death. If you then remove the cocaine, that behavior will eventually extinguish, meaning that the mouse will eventually stop pressing the lever and go off and do other things. But if you then expose that animal to an intense, painful foot shock, the first thing the animal will do is run over to the lever and start manically pressing it. So again, this is a very complex system. That pleasure-pain balance is deep in our phylogenetically old, very conserved limbic structures. And then we have all this gray matter on top that interprets these signals and these reflexes in various ways and informs how we respond to them.
Do you want to talk? I mean, why is it then that some people are susceptible to more of an imbalance than others? Or, for example, you know, my husband can have one piece of chocolate and be like, that was great. And I'll maybe have more next month. And I'm like, I'll have that whole bar and then I'll be dying tomorrow morning. Why is it that some people, I mean, this is the stop-go model, or it's just maybe a simplistic view of looking at people's susceptibility to addiction, but can we explain that from your model of dopamine, you know, homeostasis?
Yeah, great question. So there are a number, obviously it's a complex, a number of things going on here. So first of all, if you look at some populations that are at increased risk for developing addiction, they will include people with co-occurring psychiatric disorders like attention deficit disorder, major depression. And there is some research showing that those individuals at baseline have lower levels of dopamine firing. And so there is a general thought that people who are innately more susceptible to addiction probably don't come into this world with a level pleasure pain balance. They probably come into this world at a slightly sub threshold, to simplify the matter, level of dopamine firing, such that even at the get go, without any a priori exposure to intoxicants, they're looking to juice up their dopamine system. And we do know from family studies and adoption studies that, for example, an individual with a biological parent or grandparent with an alcohol use disorder is at increased risk for developing an alcohol use disorder, even if raised outside of that alcohol using home. So there is this genetic load, what we used to call the addictive personality, what we now just call a genetic vulnerability or a family history vulnerability for addiction. However, I will say that I think a lot of this has to do with drug of choice. And that really, once any of us finds whatever our particular drug of choice is, we will be off and running. For your husband, it is not chocolate. For you, it is. I used to think that I was immune to the problem of addiction. I have immediate relatives with alcohol use disorder, but alcohol does absolutely nothing for me. So I thought, oh, addiction gene, I don't have it. It turns out I just hadn't yet met my drug of choice, which turned out to be pornography in the form of romance novels that I somehow discovered in my early 40s. And I think just generally the area of like a social attachment would be, my particular drug of choice and all the different forms that that can come in. So including, by the way, validation, regard, email checking. I'm not on social media because I know I couldn't handle it. Ruminating about my intimate relationships, codependency tendencies. So that whole category is really, my drug of choice. So I think that it probably ultimately has to do with drug of choice almost more than anything else.
Well, that's so insightful and interesting. And it's good because it helps us all self-reflect, right, on where we are. And again, it takes away this kind of, like you said, this condescending model of, oh, people with addiction are just not strong enough. They're not making the right choices in life. It really just has to do with what we're exposed to and then what our set point is, whether that's due to genetics or adverse child events or ongoing trauma or psychiatric conditions, et cetera.
Exactly. Yep. You said it perfectly.
Thinking about this model and when we get about treatment, I really liked when you talked about the approach of encouraging your patients to press on the pain side. So talk about that a little bit more. And then you talked about these dopamine fasts and you encourage like the 4-week dopamine fast for patients. So what are the typical results that you would expect someone to get from that? And how long do you think the duration of effect should be?
Yeah, great. So yeah, we talk a lot about screening and brief intervention, but we don't much talk about what the brief intervention should look like. So to me, the brief intervention that we've been using for a long time is first abstain, then maintain, then seek out pain. And the first abstain, going back to the pleasure pain balance, is this idea that if we can abstain for long enough for those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off the pain side of the balance and for homeostasis to be restored, we will have achieved a number of very important things. Number one, we will have restored our baseline healthier levels of dopamine firing. Maybe not completely, but we've headed in that direction. And that will allow us, number one, to take joy in other more modest rewards, which is super important because, of course, our addiction gradually leeches pleasure from everything else that we do, including, frankly, using our drug of choice. But the other really important thing is it allows for that aha moment where patients can say, oh, my God, who was that person who was spending 24/7 all that money and energy and creativity into getting the drug, using the drug, hiding drug use? Like, I don't even recognize that person. But when we're in our addiction and when we're chasing dopamine, we cannot see it. And so getting that kind of break really makes that possible. The maintain part is this recognition that we can't rely on willpower alone, especially in an addictogenic world, which is the world we live in now. So we need to create self-binding strategies, that is both literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice, recognizing that even just being reminded of our drug of choice releases a little bit of dopamine, followed by a little dopamine deficit state, which sets us up for the craving that then makes us really want to do the work to get the drug. So insulating ourselves from that. And by the way, that's probably how naltrexone works for alcohol use disorder, right? Why does naltrexone help with craving? By blocking the opioid receptor, it means that when we think about drinking, which is itself a trigger, it doesn't release that little bit of dopamine that then gets us craving, that then makes us want to go use, because we've dampened that whole system. Again, if you go back to the pleasure-pain balance, you might think about that as a kind of, once you've achieved homeostasis, putting medication guards as a kind of self-binding strategy so that we don't tip to the side of pleasure when we're going by the bar where we usually drink, right? So it's a way to kind of insulate that whole mechanism. And then the seeking out pain is super counterintuitive, but it works. And the science shows that when we intentionally press on the pain side, those gremlins will actually move over to the pleasure side of the balance, and we'll get our dopamine indirectly by paying for it up front, which is a much better way to do it because it's much less vulnerable to the addictive process. We don't go into that dopamine deficit state or that state of craving. Obviously, we're not talking about cutting on ourselves, right, or extreme forms of exercise that would be harmful to the body. But we are talking about, you know, modest exercise, ice cold water immersion, healthy intermittent fasting, meditation, prayer, anything that requires effortful engagement that isn't necessarily fun in the moment, but afterwards we feel better for it. So that's essentially the intervention. It's not something that we would do for someone who is at risk for life-threatening alcohol, opioid, or benzo withdrawal. But in our clinical setting, we have many patients, even who use those drugs, some of whom are able to just stop their alcohol, for example, and not go into life-threatening withdrawal. For those who are at risk, we would obviously do want to do a medically monitored taper. Now, the most important thing that we tell our patients who engage in this dopamine fast or this abstinence trial, and by the way, we recommend 4 weeks, is that they will feel worse before they feel better. If we don't tell them that, they will abandon the project. Because a lot of folks with addiction think either I'm going to use my drug and be miserable, or I'm going to stop using my drug and be miserable. But there's no third space where I stop using my drug and I'm not miserable. And we say, you know what? You're right about that in the first 2 weeks. But if you can just wait long enough for those gremlins to hop off the pain side of balance, you will get to this place where you are not using your drug and you are genuinely feeling better.
It's so true. And I just came from the jail, and it's so amazing to watch people who are in forced sobriety actually attain that as well.
Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. That's why I love this work. People are like, oh, it's so depressing. How do you do it? It's like, I know, it's not depressing at all. It's so wonderful. With me actually not having to do any of the work, the patients do all the work. They get better. It's so much fun.
No, it's so fun to see people get better and just come alive and actually see they actually feel much better. So in terms of advising, so obviously the abstinence portion of it, you recommend 4 week dopamine fast and then maintain. Just you put up those medication guardrails. Obviously, there's other psychosocial things you can do in recovery to do that, and then seek out pain. Do you in your clinic recommend that people do this periodically? Is it an individual kind of treatment plan approach of like, well, we really want to, you know, people want to do cold water immersion, you know, initially every day? I mean, is it very prescriptive, or do you let people kind of decide what they need to do?
Well, you know, usually when we are in that first pass, suggesting a 30-day or 4-week dopamine fast, which, by the way, is an amount of time that we suggest because it's like the bare minimum, and people are also willing to do that. If I come in and I say, oh, you have a terrible alcohol use disorder, never drink again, I'm not going to get anywhere. So the 4 weeks is also like, it's like, okay, in the broad scheme of your life, can you give me 4 weeks? Right. And our patient population, many of them can do that. That's not going to be true for all patients. They're going to need a higher level of care, right? Even if they want to do 4 weeks, they can't. But for the patients who can, we then explain the purpose of the dopamine fast, resetting reward pathways, gremlins hopping off the pain side of the balance, restoring healthy dopamine firing, getting back to baseline homeostasis. And then typically they'll say, well, what do I do if I have cravings? And then we'll say, well, you know, this might surprise you, but you can do something that's more painful than the pain of craving. That would be something like taking an ice cold water bath or immersing your face in an ice cold water or doing sit-ups or push-ups or going outside. So you want to really tailor it to that individual. For many, many of our patients, just getting up off the couch and going outside is like climbing Mount Everest. But occasionally we'll get like the professional triathlete for whom they might actually have to climb Mount Everest for that to be, you know, sufficiently hormetic. Hormesis is a Greek term that means to set in motion. And essentially what we're doing is by using mild to moderate doses of toxic or painful stimuli, we're triggering the body's own self-healing mechanisms and the upregulation of feel-good neurotransmitters like our endogenous opioids, endogenous cannabinoids. So yeah, we introduced that right away as sort of, you know, along with all the other things you introduce, along with medications that might help. It's all sort of part of the package.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Yeah. So I was wondering when I was rereading your book, but how do you approach really recommending abstinence, which we all know is the best approach to reset this hedonic set point and for people in general in terms of negative consequences, with the harm reduction approach? when you have people who are just not, they're just not there yet. They're not ready to stop using, especially things like cannabis and with low perceived harm, which of course they're not really. How do you approach that? Is it just all conversation and motivational interviewing? I'm really interested in how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very transparent when I work with patients. I just kind of say to them, okay, you know, even if your long-term goal is to just reduce your use, whether it's alcohol or cannabis or what have you, I just say in my clinical experience, it's people are more successful in reducing their use if they first take a break and really reset reward pathways. And when you explain the reward pathways, what they realize is if you just go down from a lot to less, you're always going to be in withdrawal. You're never going to get to that place where you like pop those dopamine receptors, you know, back into action. And you can like enjoy other things. So if we're going to do the project of moderation, let's first do the 4 weeks of abstinence, and then let's make a really detailed plan, because the devil is in the details here, for what your use is going to look like. And then I just say, and I promise you, your chances of success with that goal of moderation are going to be higher if you first take a break and then we go back to using. And I just think the insight and accountability isn't there when people are just, you know, in the city. They really need to get that distance. I'll just say that. I'll just use my experience. I mean, at some point you're like, you're old enough and you've been doing it long. It's like, hey, this is what I've seen. This is what I've seen work. This is what I've seen. The other thing that I find helpful is to, again, have people identify with their future selves. I just used this the other day to good effect for a patient regarding their cannabis and nicotine combined use. I always say, well, okay, you're not interested in giving it up now. You're 25. Do you think you'll still be smoking this way when you're 35? It's so interesting. 99.9% of the time when you ask them that, they're like, oh no, oh no. When I'm 35, I won't be using cannabis like this, or I won't be smoking. Really? Great. Okay, how about when you're 30? It's like, nah, I'm not going to be doing this when I'm 30. Person's 25, by the way. Okay, how about when you're 27 and a half? Probably not. Okay. 26. I mean, you just keep going down. And all of a sudden they realize, I mean, if the plan is going to happen, why not now? Right. So that's another way you can kind of get people to sort of get a little bit different perspective. And I learned that from a patient of mine who had a very serious opioid use disorder. He got to a year of using progressive severity, living essentially, you know, in a drug shack, dealing, using, and he just got to a year. And for him, suddenly it was like, oh, wow, I've been doing this for a year. Oh, wow. I guess if I do it more than a year, I might be doing it forever. So suddenly he was able to pull himself out of the narrow perspective of his life right now and see himself over the trajectory of his entire life. And that kind of jolted his awareness.
Excellent. Thank you.
So give that a try.
Oh, I will. I love it.
I really appreciated your candor and sharing your own experiences in your writing. How do you encourage your patients to embrace that concept of radical honesty in their recovery?
Well, first of all, I learned it from my patients, right? So that's not something that I sort of discovered and taught them. They taught me that after so many years of seeing patients and having them, no matter how they got into recovery, so many of them saying, oh yeah, I can't lie. It's not that I can't lie about just not, it's not just that I can't lie about my use. I can't lie about anything. I can't lie about what I had for breakfast. I can't lie about why I was 5 minutes late to the meeting. Because once I start those little lies, that'll spin into those big lies and I'll be using again. I was totally fascinated by that. I was like, what is it about that? And I think it works on many different levels, as I talk about in the book. I think it promotes intimacy, which is its own healthy dopamine explosion. I think that it probably strengthens our prefrontal cortex, which is that large gray matter area behind the forehead, so important for delayed gratification, appreciating future consequences, autobiographical narrative. I think it's contagious. Lying is contagious. Truth telling is contagious. So I think it's really fascinating. And I will actually prescribe it. So when I'm prescribing the dopamine fast, I will say, you know, part of what happens in addiction is something we call the lying habit, where we're leading this double life, you know, doing our addiction over here and pretending not just to others, but even to ourselves, that we're not engaging in that life. So part of what I'm going to ask you to do to promote awareness to yourself is that over this next 4 weeks or 30 days of the dopamine fast, that you set up a little watcher in your brain, and that job of that watcher is to make sure that you don't lie about anything. And I said, and what you will be surprised by, number one, is how often you lie, because we all lie all the time. We're like lying machines. Occasionally I'll meet someone who says like, oh, I never lie. It's like, no, you're not paying attention. Because if you're paying attention, we're always massaging the data to make ourselves look more interesting, more ethical, you know, whatever it is. But you set up that little kind of observer and try hard to tell the truth. It's really hard to use when you're doing that.
No, I love it. I do. I think we do learn so much from our patients. And taking that into our own lives, I think it is really helpful. And just take it into our practice.
Yeah.
And you, like you talked before, just the transparency also with our patients.
Oh, it's so good.
That's really important.
Yeah.
It's excellent. Excellent challenge. Excellent chance to take on ourselves. So yeah, thank you so much. We didn't really talk about, I was hoping we could talk about process addictions, because you
heard
it really well. And, you know, I think that's what's, well, we all know that this is really just the underbelly of addiction, especially in this country and in Western culture, and people are becoming more aware of it. And you said like this younger generation, they know, I mean, they're smart and they know. And they're looking for help, like on social media. It's just a buzz, you know. We do social media for the podcast, and it's amazing to see what people are talking about and worried about.
Yes.
And it's like a runaway train, kind of like with social media and all of the.
Yes, it's really exploded. Overwhelming.
Right. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything about process addictions.
Just really quickly, you know, a question that comes up very often is like, how am I supposed to do a dopamine fast when I have to be on technology for my work? Or how am I supposed to do, you know, a dopamine fast from my sex addiction when my partner, you know, wants to have sex with me, or I want to have sex with my partner in a healthy way? This is where, you know, kind of having these categories, or for that matter, you know, food, right? Food addiction, which is being increasingly recognized as its own kind of addiction that straddles a substance and a behavioral addiction or process addiction. So, you know, we do the same exact intervention for sex addiction and compulsive masturbation. We'll say for 4 weeks, no orgasms with yourself or anybody else, right? For food addiction, it's usually no ultra processed foods or sugars for 4 weeks. For technology addiction, it's only use your devices, or let me put it this way as a negative, do not use your device for entertainment or to change the way you feel, right? Which is kind of a really nice bottom line, especially for people who have to use the device for work. And don't also rationalize that you're using it for work when you're really not using it for work. So those are the types of things that we talk about to help kind of frame behaviors that we can't give up entirely, or the goal is not to give them up entirely, but we're at least trying to kind of reset reward pathways.
Excellent. Those are wonderful, excellent, concrete examples. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you again for joining us. We know that you're...
Thank you to you. You guys did great, great questions. I always feel a kinship talking to other addiction medicine docs. So, you know, so nice to talk to you, and thank you for your work. It's nice. Sometimes you can sort of feel like there aren't very, very many of us. In fact, there aren't very many of us, but it's always nice to connect.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, hope to see you soon. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Until next time, hey, check us out at theaddictionfiles.com or email us at theaddictionfiles@gmail.com. Thank you so much to Ricky Valades for use of his song, Awake. Check him out at rickyvalades.com.
entertainment and education purposes only. Hosts and guests are not responsible for any harm caused by information obtained from this source. As each person is unique, you're advised to seek the advice of your own healthcare professional to treat any medical conditions you may be having. Opinions expressed on the show are those of the Addiction Files and not of our respective employers.